Hello there. Today is Tuesday, August 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington coming up. As the U.S. midterm elections approach, concerns grow over the threat of cyber attacks.
The reality is that our national cyber systems are under active threat by major nation states, including Russia.
Economic plan sows confusion in Venezuela. Pope Francis, a stern statement, yet most stern statement yet on priest sex abuse. And a movie blockbuster hits U.S. theaters. It's all on today's International Edition. Venezuela has slashed five zeros from its currency as part of a broad economic plan put forward by President Nicolas Maduro, who says it will tame hyperinflation. But critics are calling it just another failed policy that will push the chaotic country deeper into crisis. The change comes with a 3,000% minimum wage hike, tax increases, and a plan to peg salaries, prices, and the country's exchange rate to the petro, an elusive state-backed cryptocurrency. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Raul Sanchez Uribarri, lecturer at La Trobe University in Australia, for reaction on these controversial measures.
As you can imagine, the situation is very confusing in Venezuela. Now, first, because the measures themselves were a bit unclear in terms of, on one hand, of how they were conceived, but also in terms of their implementation. There are a lot of doubts and concerns about how exactly the plan is going to be implemented. So out of a combination of, on one hand, the brutal nature of the measures themselves, as you know, and on the other hand, uncertainty with respect to its implementation, we start the week in Venezuela, based on what I know, with lots of concerns about what's going to happen in the short and mid-run.
This is a country gripped in a crisis for years. There's very difficult to find drinking water, medical shortages, food shortages, and of course hyperinflation that the IMF predicts could reach 1,000,000% by the end of the year.
Correct. And that's exactly the situation as we know it right now. As you know, this has resulted on one hand on a crisis of migrants and refugees leaving Venezuela, unfortunately, in droves. And we're talking about at least a couple of million people apparently have left in the past 2 or 3 years alone. I mean, this is a staggering figure. So, of course, for the government, it's one of the urgent tasks, it seems to be, to stop hyperinflation. And this is one of the key issues. And certainly that's supposed to be the main goal of the plan. It's supposed to be an adjustment plan that's set to stabilize the economy. That's supposed to be the ostensible goal. And on the other hand, try to stop the high level of inflation and bring some stability for the economy, essentially.
The president of the business organization, Fede Camaras, said that pegging the bolivar to the petro seems to be a serious mistake. He described the new economic plan unveiled Monday as incoherent.
Well, that's exactly one of the issues. I mean, on one hand, we're talking about pegging it to the petro, which is itself a government-sponsored cryptocurrency. I mean, imagine the sort of the questions that this raises. And ultimately, if there was a sense that the relationship or the exchange relationship between the petro and the price of dollar and bolivares that are ultimately bolivares soberanos that are ultimately linked to them would be stable and honored, then it would be a different story. But who is going to say that the exchange rate is not going to be manipulated itself? And that's precisely the problem, right? I mean, on one hand, again, the obscure nature of the measures themselves, but on the other hand, the implementation is in the end in the hands of a government that has a really poor reputation with international creditors and with the business community overall. And so we will need to see. The proof is in the pudding, but the Maduro government doesn't start with high levels of reputation and with any substantial backing from any international financial institution or anything like that.
That's Raul Sanchez Uribarri, lecturer at La Trobe University in Australia. Top U.S. intelligence officials have predicted that hackers working for foreign governments will target the 2018 and 2020 elections in the U.S. With the 2018 midterms just a few months away, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats recently said that the threat of a devastating cyber assault on critical U.S. infrastructure is growing, saying the warning lights are blinking red again. Coats said Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea are launching daily cyber strikes on the computer networks of federal, state, and local government agencies, U.S. corporations, and academic institutions, with Russia by far the most aggressive foreign actor. We've also heard in recent weeks of several U.S. lawmakers saying that their computer systems were compromised. Joining us now to talk more about this is Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. So the midterm elections are coming up. How big of a security concern is this?
Well, look, Lori, these are huge issues. Obviously, the Russians have made an active effort in the prior election to undermine confidence in our electoral system and confidence in our democratic institutions, and they're continuing that process. In fact, they're actually getting more aggressive. We saw the Director of National Intelligence a couple weeks ago refer to the system as blinking red, words that have not been used since 9/11 to describe the level of terrorist chatter back then and today the situation with the Russian threat. You have the Secretary of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, describing our democracy as being, quote, in the crosshairs. I mean, these are strong words, and they're being used by these senior national security officials to refer to the threat posed by Russian actors to our elections and our democratic process.
My understanding is, though, that what doesn't make sense is that the person in charge of cybersecurity was let go, and we don't have anyone.
Yeah, look, it's certainly concerning that the White House doesn't have a number one lead point person the prior administration did on these issues. That's concerning. Obviously, there's a restructuring going on in the National Security Council writ large, but not having a cybersecurity leader there is a mistake. They do have two people that divided the job amongst two folks, so it's not that the responsibility is completely gone. But not having one point person, I do think, is a tactical error by the administration.
My understanding is that cybersecurity is a grave threat to our national security. Do you agree?
Well, look, absolutely. Cybersecurity is a major, major threat to our national security. We obviously depend on these information technology systems. They're at the heart of our day-to-day business transactions. They're the way we conduct our day-to-day lives, at the heart of our financial system, our electric system. So the ability to harm our national cyber systems is a huge issue, and the reality is that our national cyber systems are under active threat by major nation states, including Russia. And the longer we continue to look away from that threat, the longer we put ourselves at risk. And the reality is we know that there are debates within the administration about who was responsible and whether the Russians did anything with respect to our election. But those debates have been settled once and for all by the intelligence community. The evidence is clear and incontrovertible. The Russians did, in fact, try to manipulate our elections and did, in fact, try to sow dissent and discord amongst Americans. And it's now time that the administration take account of that and take action directly to prevent that from happening again.
My understanding is it's still happening.
It's ongoing. It's an ongoing threat. And the fact is that the measures taken thus far by the administration have not been fully effective. And that means more than just another set of sanctions or another sort of light slap at Vladimir Putin. And it takes more than a disagreement between parts of the executive branch on whether, in fact, the Russians did it or didn't do it. We know they did it, and they need to be told that they're going to pay the price if they continue to do it. The president has regularly talked tough with Iran and North Korea, and at times that tough talk, backed up by potential action, has been effective. The president wants to be effective against Russia. He needs to talk tough and stand behind those tough words.
Do you have any other ideas as far as what we should be doing?
One of the things that we need to do as a country better when it comes to cybersecurity is working together private industry and the public sector. We often talk about the need for public-private partnerships in this space, but it has to be more than words. And what that really means is it's not just sharing information about threats, but it's actually being able to take action. It means having the right authorities in place and the right policies and procedures and systems in place so that when we're in a time of national crisis, the government can step up, take advantage of its authorities, and take action. And right now, today, in this country, we don't think about our problem as a collective defense problem. We think about it as a problem for one industry or one company or the government, but not all of us collectively as a nation. And until we get to the point where we're talking about collective defense, we're not going to be effective at going up against the toughest attackers coming after us, whether those are nation states or criminal groups.
All right. Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump calls the Mueller-Russia probe a national disgrace. The papal letter to Catholics condemns clerical sexual abuse and the cover-up. Kenya takes a ride on Chinese rail with billions in debt aboard. And a report finds experts knew a Genoa Bridge that collapsed had weakened 20%. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. In a letter to the world's billion-plus Catholics, Pope Francis has condemned clerical sexual abuse and its cover-up. The Pope said the Church must recognize and condemn the abuse with sorrow and shame. Much of the abuse was directed at minors. Sabina Castelfranco has more from Rome.
Never before has Pope Francis written to all Catholics, or as he put it, the people of God, on the crime of clerical sexual abuse. His letter was issued in seven languages. In his letter, the Pope mentioned the publication last week of a detailed Pennsylvania grand jury report on sexual abuse by the clergy involving more than 1,000 victims in the U.S. state over a period of 70 years. Papal spokesman Greg Burke commented on the Pope's letter.
It's significant that the Pope calls abuse a crime, not only a sin, and that he asks for forgiveness, but he acknowledges that no effort to repair the damage done will ever be sufficient for victims and survivors.
Francis said, looking ahead to the future, no effort must be spared to create a culture able to prevent such situations from happening, but also to prevent the possibility of their being covered up and perpetuated. He also wrote, no effort to beg pardon and to seek to repair the harm done will ever be sufficient. The pontiff also acknowledged that as a church community, we did not act in a timely manner, realizing the magnitude and the gravity of the damage done to so many lives. We showed no care for the little ones. We abandoned them. The Pope begged for forgiveness, adding it is essential for the Church to be able to acknowledge and condemn with sorrow and shame the atrocities perpetrated by consecrated persons, clerics, and all those entrusted with the mission of watching over and caring for those most vulnerable. The letter did not mention any new measures that would be adopted. The international research group bishopsaccountability.org Monday launched a database containing the names of more than 70 Irish clergy convicted or credibly accused of sexually abusing children. Several other countries are facing similar scandals, including Argentina, Australia, and Chile. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
El Salvador has become the latest country to sever ties with Taiwan and recognize mainland China. That reduces the number of countries recognizing Taiwan to 17. Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, insists the self-ruled island will not bow to pressure after her high-profile trip to Latin America, including stops in the United States, which drew criticism from China. While Tsai was not invited to the U.S. foreign official visit, she met with U.S. senators, attended banquets, and spoke of the need for strong ties with Washington. China, which claims Taiwan as its territory, has ramped up military and diplomatic pressure in an attempt to assert Chinese sovereignty over the island. How much pressure are Taiwan, China, and the U.S. under? Well, that's the question VOA Asia's Ira Melman asks of Matthew Fanioli, a fellow in the China Power Project at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Well, the pressure now is certainly more intense than it's been either with President Tsai's first visit or with visits by previous presidents from Taiwan. And I think that a lot of that has to do with personality. I mean, Beijing has targeted Tsai, has identified Tsai as someone who they perceive to be trying to undermine cross-strait relations or upset the status quo. And so really anything that she was going to do on this visit had certainly had the potential to intensify cross-strait relations. I think that sort of interesting thing that you see now is that Beijing has started to try to target foreign companies with the sort of airline restrictions earlier, wanting airlines to sort of refer to Taiwan as a province of China. And now, in this little bit of from sides visit, they're targeting the Taiwanese coffee company, 85 degrees C, which she made a visit to and she had coffee at. And now, as a response to it, there's been protests in Beijing against protests and boycott against going to the coffee shop. So things are certainly heating up, I guess you could say, as far as the sort of response that you see from the transit. And now there's definitely a sort of commercial angle to it as well.
In contrast to that type of criticism, the Pentagon came out a few days ago and said that China, at least as far as they are concerned, seems to be beefing up its military, making sure that its long-range bombers can reach the United States and Taiwan. And there have been other instances of China seemingly bolstering its defenses, if not offenses, for the United States and Taiwan. Can you expand on that at all?
Really sort of two things to keep in mind here. I mean, one is that with any state, as it gets richer and more powerful, it's going to look to build up its military. So that's natural as far as international politics are concerned. Where the United States and where Taiwan, where Japan and where other countries in the region have questions is the intentionality behind those growing capabilities. And there seems to be an increased fear among those countries that China may wish to use these new platforms and these new technologies to rebuff the existing rules-based international order. And we really see that happening in places like the South China Sea, where China has continued to militarize the artificial islands in the area. And it seems to be pushing back against what the U.S. and the rest of the countries in the region have really relied on, which is freedom of navigation and which is the sort of free exchange of ideas and free trade.
There was a headline in The Guardian a few months ago, in April, as a matter of fact, saying, will China turn Taiwan into the next Crimea? Now, do you see anything about, you know, China maybe ratcheting up so much that there is the possibility of military action against Taiwan?
Well, I mean, I think that in their strategic planning for Beijing, they're always sort of thinking about this contingency and thinking about having the capabilities for it. What I think that you're seeing on a number of different fronts is are always a response to that potential threat. I think the United States, with its strategic planning, takes this into account and attempts to counter any efforts that may be trying to ramp up towards that. And I think Taiwan is as well.
All right. That was Matthew Funnelowe of CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, Americans drink a lot of beer. According to the Beer Institute, almost 100 liters for every drinking age American each year. That is a lot of malted barley, the main ingredient that gives beer its alcoholic kick. Even smaller craft breweries in the U.S. alone throw out some 2 million tons of the spent grain each year into landfills. But one entrepreneur has found other uses for all of that wasted grain, and she is recycling spent barley into flour that she later sells to bakeries and restaurants. VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Beer may not seem like a big culprit in the battle to fight food waste, but the beer brewing process uses up thousands of kilos of barley. After the malted grain has been soaked in hot water to release its sugars, the resulting golden brew is fermented into alcohol, and the spent grain is thrown away.
And in, just in New York City, there are 6,000 tons that goes to a landfill every year. So if we can at least start making New York zero waste, that would be great.
Bertha Jimenez and her team recycle used barley grain and turn it into flour by drying, then grinding, sifting, and packaging the flour by hand. The result is a so-called super flour that's either light or dark. Lights come from the IPAs, ales, and pilsners. The darks come from the stouts and the porter ales.
Oh, we call it super flour because of the nutrition. So it has, if you compare to an all-purpose flour, it will have 2 times the protein, 12 times the fiber, and only 1/3 of the carbs of an all-purpose flour.
Baker Peter Indris buys super flour to make shortbread cookies. He says he wants to help reduce America's food waste problem while still making a tasty product.
Because it has like a nice crumbly texture, and it's a lot more full flavored than other flours. You really taste like a maltiness from the beer making process.
But those full flavors come at a premium. Rise's super flour currently costs about 5 times that of regular all-purpose flour. But Jimenez says she hopes future automation will eventually lower the price. That should leave some of us more money to spend on beer. Jill Craig, VOA News, Washington.
Well, the highly anticipated movie Crazy Rich Asians, the first Hollywood film with a mainly Asian cast in a generation, dazzled North America in its debut weekend in the U.S. The adaptation of the best-selling novel of the same name took in just over $35 million since hitting theaters on Wednesday. It tells the story of an American economics professor who meets her super wealthy boyfriend's family in Singapore.
Eleanor, is Nikki bringing a girl to Colin's wedding? My Amanda heard it from my friend Francesca.
Eddie says her name is Rachel Chu.
Oh, I thought that Nick was coming alone. Did you know he had a girlfriend?
Nick dates many girls. It's hard to keep track.
Amanda knows everyone and she has never heard of her.
Rachel Chu. Or maybe she's from the Taiwan Plastics Chu family.
If you want, I have a private investigator, very discreet.
Well, joining us now is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, you just saw the movie. I understand it's the first major studio release in decades with an all-Asian cast.
Yeah, I believe The Joy Luck Club was the last Asian-American movie with all Asian-American cast members 25 years ago. You know, it's good that Hollywood is starting to finally, you know, showing other groups, other ethnicities on the big screen. But the thing is, when I watched this movie, I really didn't say to myself, oh, look, it's all an Asian American cast. Mm-hmm. It was just an Asian story. And it's based on the best-selling book, it is a trilogy of books, about a young woman whose mother came to America, a Chinese immigrant. She worked 2 jobs, really worked, you know, her fingers to the bone to get her girl through college, to give her a chance at a better life than hers. And she ended up being an economics professor at NYU. She falls in love with her new boyfriend, and after being a year together, she really doesn't know anything about his background or his family until he says, look, we need to go to a family wedding in Singapore. Little did she know, when she gets over there, she finds out that he is not only one of the world's most eligible bachelors, but his family is rich, crazy rich in real estate. We're talking old money like a Rockefeller or a Vanderbilt. So she's thrust into this world of opulence, of money, of just unbelievable surroundings compared to where she came from in Brooklyn. So the movie is a Cinderella story, but what's great is Constance Wu, who stars in the ABC series Fresh Off the Boat. She is wonderful. She is charming. She is fighting against his mother, played by Michelle Yeoh, who thinks, you know, traditional Chinese and what women, their place in the relationship concerning with the husband. And she, of course, is being criticized because she's American Chinese. So there's a culture clash even within the Chinese family about being American, being someone from the homeland. So overall, the movie is fun, it's energetic, it's romantic. I really had a great time with this movie. It's got some really great character actors in it, especially Awkwafina, who's this great comedian. She steals every scene she's in. And Kevin Yeoh from Hangover, you remember him as Mr. Chow? He's hysterical in this. So it's a who's who of American Asian actors in this. They're all incredible. I had a blast with this. And I think anyone who sees it is just going to come out. Is it formulaic? Absolutely. But you know what? Who cares? Formulas work sometimes, and this time it works tremendously.
Especially when they're feel-good movies.
Absolutely. And I think the music is so great in the film. You think it's almost like a musical version of The Great Gatsby. But they don't sing, but it's just got energy. It's got incredible production design. And it's just a wonderful film. It really is.
Awesome. I can't wait to see it. Okay, well, what about Mark Wahlberg's new film, Mile 22? How'd you like that?
Well, you know, Mark Wahlberg and director Peter Berg, this is like their third film together. I think the last one was Lone Survivor, and they did also Patriot Day. So this time they give us an exciting action film where he's a CIA operative, and his team has the most challenging mission yet. They're in an undisclosed Indonesian country when one of their citizens has incredible information for them on a hard drive. And he says, look, I'll give you the code, but you've got to get me out of the country. So from the American embassy to the airport is 22 miles. So the entire movie is them traveling from the embassy to the airport under the most ridiculous conditions. You know, there's car chases, there's gun battles, there's a special team directing them through the city led by John Malkovich. They're called the Overwatch Committee. So they're telling him, turn down this street. There's a bad guy on your left. They're using all these drones and all this high-tech technology. And so the movie moves really fast at an hour and a half. It's got tremendous action. But unfortunately, there's no character development. So we really don't know Mark Wahlberg or his team's backstory much. And it's like you don't care about them. It's just when you just have lots of action and nothing, no foundation underneath it, it just kind of seems like an empty kind of Transformers kind of movie where it's just action, 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 but there's no substance to it. So while it's not a horrible film, it's disappointing because I expected more from Mark Wahlberg and better characters. So I'm kind of mixed on it.
That was Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Thanks for joining us today on International Edition. Find us anytime at VOAnews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On a recent visit to Brazil, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis emphasized the shared values of the hemisphere's two largest democracies, the U.S. and Brazil, as defenders of democracy, fundamental human rights, the rule of law, and peace at home and abroad. These values find expression in Article 1 of the Inter-American Democratic Charter. The peoples of the Americas have a right to democracy, and their governments have an obligation to promote and defend it. The U.S. remains focused on strengthening its military-to-military relationships with Brazil because it seeks a collaborative, prosperous, and secure hemisphere where each country individually and collectively maintains situational awareness in all domains— air, land, sea, outer space, and cyberspace. It's a hemisphere where we address national, regional, and hemispheric priorities together, declared Secretary Mattis. The U.S. would like to work with Brazil to strengthen a cooperative, strategic partnership that is transparent, that is trustworthy, and that is steady, because we see a bright future ahead for Brazil and for our hemisphere, said Secretary Mattis. We see this future reflected in Brazil's demonstrated global leadership, from demining missions in Central and South America to peacekeeping missions in Haiti, Lebanon, and Central Africa. We see this future in your prudent response to Venezuela's destabilizing actions. In the broader military relationship, the U.S. sees future opportunities for advanced research with Brazil, particularly in space. The U.S. also looks for future two-way military sales. America is not looking to make quick cash, explained Secretary Mattis. We are looking to earn and keep friends, sharing our most combat-proven technology while drawing on your areas of expertise. We believe it is in America's best interests that Brazil's industrial base be internationally competitive. the U.S. military seeks to work side by side with Brazil and with Brazil's neighbors to build a future together, one that shares all the benefits of living in our great hemisphere, said Secretary Mattis. It should be an island of democracy and prosperity in an unstable world. Our hemisphere should show the way and be a model.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.